Hello, and you're listening to The Seventh Reel. This week, The Other Side of the Wind, a 2018 film directed by Orson Welles.
Not really.
How did he manage it? We'll find out. Okay, well...
kind of, I guess.
kind of. It is very much him. And The Clouds of Sils Maria, or apparently just Sils Maria, a 2014 film directed by Olivier Assayas. Both of these films, Yusuf, this was your pick?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to watch movies about making movies. I like that.
Oh, you sure got that.
But, I mean, I think I picked a really good one, and then I picked a really terrible one.
You think you overplayed your hand a bit?
Not overplayed my hand. I just, I've started The Other Side of the Wind several times. And
really?
Yeah, and then I won't watch it. And they'll just be like,
I'll be honest.
So I use the
I'm podcast. Trying to be a contrarian here because both Yusuf and Michelle have watched this film before me. And they both, I guess you can guys, it's not going to say that you guys don't like this.
No, I did not enjoy this.
So I watched in one go with the intent of trying to find something to like, and guess
so,
what?
So, yeah, what did
I
you like?
I have not returned empty-handed.
Well, tell us.
All right. I love the look of the film. I love the constant switch between 16mm and 35mm cinema. Like the movie within the film. The film within the film looks lush and gorgeous, 35 print. And then the party, you know, it's erratic, it's handheld, it's like 16mm or even 8mm home video. I love that difference.
But
and
it's too much. It's too much. I was going to puke.
I love the editing. It is a constant race against the audience's expectations on how fast can I cut from one shot to the next? And how quickly, like, and how many shots can I even compile into just one little sequence? Best example I can think of is the first official scene that you see of the film within the film when she goes to the bathroom.
Yeah.
I love that. That was so cool. So cool. I'm sorry. Dug it. Very aesthetic. It also feels like Orson Welles trying to play around with what even is like new wave filmmaking, what even is modern like art. How can I even stay relevant? And also admitting to himself and the audience that, yeah, you know, cinema is great. And also I am kind of a creep who just likes... I'm kind of a horny creep, and that's okay.
Well, okay.
That's kind of his self-admittance of that.
No, I can understand your interest in that side of things, because as I was watching it, I was like, okay, it felt like this older man who knows that, you know, the movies have changed, and he's like making a movie about a guy who's making a movie that has...
and losing the plot of like what even is...
Yeah, and Dennis Hopper is talking about how, you know, there's a shot in it where he's talking about how he wants to get, I guess, John Wayne's audience or whatever. I think that element of it is interesting, but it's not enough to warrant, like, me watching this movie. I don't know. It's very
self-indulgent.
Yeah, it wasn't even self-indulgent. There was nothing to it. Everyone just kept trying to say like a cool quip, and then and it was so cringy. Everyone's like, "Oh, the Peter Bogdanovich just being like, isn't that it, Skipper?" And then he's like, "Well, time is whatever, and get me another drink." It was just none of it was clever. None of it was clever. It was just a bunch of empty. Reminded me of Lion's Love or whatever, the Agnes Varda movie. That was kind of the same thing, where it was just Lion's Love and Lies. You know, it was just like a bunch of people saying stuff that was like, oh, it's deep, but it's not.
You can tell Peter Bogdanovich thinks he's so cool in this movie.
Michelle,
what did you think? I want to know what you think.
So my notes just say, awful, stupid, sexist.
Yeah, the whole thing is just her like walking around naked and them filming it, and it's like
the greatest ass shots in cinema. It's crazy how horny this movie is.
You know what's insane is the movie within the movie is it looks beautiful, but it's just
it looks
nothing
beautiful.
Yeah.
It's nothing. Yeah. It's like a music video. It's like, well, you know,
it,
you
can... Wow, I never thought about the music video. That's, yes, you're absolutely right that it feels like a music video. And a very modern music video, too.
But how much, yeah. But it, how much of this did Orson Welles do? And how much is people playing around with it?
He shot all of it. I know he shot, like, they finished production, like, principal production.
Was the order set, or did they move that around?
I'm not sure about, like, the order. Apparently, there were multiple cuts of this film. The first, I think, internet available copy was apparently showed up in 2011. Mm-hmm. And then, like, they picked it up back again. Oh, there is the, yeah, they finished shooting it. By 1976, principal photography was completely completed. And then it's just a matter of finishing it. Apparently this film's, they have to stop shooting because one of their investors embezzled and ran off with money, like a lot of money. And
it's good. So funny to do that.
He saw what a piece of shit this was and decided to bail the fuck out.
I feel like Orson Welles knew that it wasn't good too. He didn't release it because of that. Because he knows what he's doing.
It ran into multiple legal disputes in terms of like who gets to have the copyrights to actually distribute and finish it. Peter Bogdanovich had a big play in it. And Oja Kodar. Oh, Kodar, who I think it's very funny how they got a Eastern European actress to play what is supposed to be a Native American, and then they continuously call her Pocahontas throughout the entire movie. It was very funny. I was like, wow, you guys do not care. Okay, whatever. So yeah, it went through multiple hands, and the main edit was done from 2014 to 2018.
Well, they should have used their lives.
Went through multiple hands. How much of, because the film within the film, the idea of like having the young actor who walked off set, to me it read to me like the director channeling his frustration and his insecurities and his emasculation all onto like this younger, beautiful, younger guy, because you know he's old and decrepit now, and he's just trying to take out his frustration out on him. I thought that was quite interesting.
I kept thinking about Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
Because like his last film, very lot of naked people, like very different from like his other film. And then also, didn't he like really psychologically damage Shelley Duvall in The Shining, like screaming at her and stuff?
Yes.
I just kept thinking about that. Mm-hmm.
That wasn't great.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting.
What about the last part when the journalist accuses him of being a homosexual? Implicitly. Not really implicitly. She kind of, I don't know. And then he slaps her. If the director is supposed to be a parallel to Orson himself, I was wondering how much of that is him trying to confront maybe that element of, maybe he is bisexual. That's him trying to confront that. But then why still, I thought that was so interesting. Because if it is meant to be read as a direct parallel of what Orson Welles' view on Hollywood and like himself, then what does that say? I don't know.
That feels too,
because all the characters are supposed to be parallel, have like, they are all supposed to have like real life parallels to people Orson Welles actually knows. Like the screenwriter, Baron, I think, like the reference, like that's how they reference him in the movie. The German guy who does his screenplays, he's based on like one of the guy who produced Citizen Kane with him. But in real life, their relationship deteriorated and the guy kind of abandons Orson Welles. But in this version, like in his fantasy, I suppose, in his ideal, like he sticks with him and like, and is like a big, it's like, no, this kid's great, this kid's got it. But
shall we talk about the other film?
The better film, I suppose.
I think so.
The Clouds of Sils Maria, starring Julia Binoche and Kirsten Stewart and Chloe Grace Moretz.
Did you think Kirsten Stewart was just best Bella again from Twilight?
She's so good in this.
I could not see Bella. It was the same attitude, the same facial expressions. I kept being confused about, oh, it's Twilight in an art film.
She's so good in this. What are you talking about, Michelle? She is so good in this. I love her in this.
I think she's just not being different.
I can see why Asayas wanted to work with her again in Personal Shopper afterwards, because she's really, 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 really
good. Why is she good?
Well, for one, she channels a lot of, like, the frustration. She obviously admires Julia Binoche's character, like, admires her a lot and wants to, like, help her out. But then her own creative struggles, like, and she, but she can see that, you know, Julia Binoche's character doesn't really appreciate her and doesn't really see her true worth. And it's too...
No, but it kind of gets, like, Persona, where they have a too, like, codependent, but way more one-sided...
Yes, that and that's why... But then she woke up and she decided to bail, and that's why she's gone by the last third of the movie. What did you guys think about that, by the way? The third act shift when Kristen Stewart's character just disappears from the movie. I thought it was brilliant.
I thought it... I mean, it represented how kind of she treated her, like she was just...
Yeah.
Interchangeable and didn't like really respect her presence despite her being mm-hmm. like very like, despite, you know, supportive of her breakdown
and incredibly attentive.
Yeah,
I love how yeah it, I think it's pretty clear cut what happens. Like her last line in the movie is literally fuck it, so like she leaves. I love that. And the last third, like the last 15 minutes of the film, I was just wondering like how much of that is because she has a new assistant, right? She gets a new assistant in London. And I'm trying to figure out how much of that she has grown from the experience of like having Kristen Stewart, her previous assistant, basically leave her, having someone she really depended on leave her. And I'm still not quite sure, even at the end of the movie, I'm pretty sure this is intentional. Both this and the Orson Welles film, I feel like, are about these aging artists coming to terms with their age, I suppose, getting mm-hmm. old.
Yeah.
And accepting that and coming to... amazing, Yusuf. I was like, wow, I was watching both of these. I was like, this is, they actually do parallel each other.
Yeah, quite nicely. Yeah, I consciously was like, wow, we should do this. But yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. They're both kind of about these mm-hmm. coming to terms with where you are and facing like the new wave of.
Well, what in your opinion makes Asayas's interpretation more successful than Orson Welles?
Well, I just think it's like a bit more like coherent and like in it's also it's just like directly not like galvanizing the main character. She's kind of like just going through this rough period of time, and it's understood yes. that she's kind of being childish about it. Like she's.
She's such a bitch sometimes. She's so mean sometimes.
Yeah. And that's kind of what is being on display here and what mm-hmm. she's trying to overcome. Whereas with the other one, it was like kind of like, oh, no. He's right. He's just nailing everything. And these people just don't understand him. So that's what I don't know. I really... really thought she is.
Although I would argue for the Welles version, like the guy was totally depicted as a sad old like creep by the end. Really? For one, he's getting progressively drunker throughout the entire thing, and also like the girl, the young girl who is heavily implied to be underage,
mm-hmm.
who like hang around. I don't think any other like this. If this is a condemnation on himself, like it's pretty searing, and like. I felt that was pretty honest, like him coming to terms with, yeah, like I'm a creep, kind of like he likes younger girls, and as such, he won't shy away from portraying him, his like.
But why do you think it's all about him, like so closely parallel to him?
Well,
couldn't it just be about like the film industry in general, just likes watching young women? Observing them,
yeah, but knowing
it's very perverted.
But knowing Orson Welles, I don't see any way that it couldn't be about him. Just like how he projected his ambitions onto Citizen Kane's character, he's kind of doing. I think he can't help. Like that's kind of what he does. I think
he also kind of like, I mean, uses both of his leads as well as like. So maybe it is about the industry, about using these like. Young, yeah. Beautiful. Well,
shoot them all dead, right? That wasn't like one of the last lines of the film.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
You shoot them all dead.
I hated this movie so much.
Yeah.
Just everything about it.
I'm sorry, guys. Hey, I only tried so hard to like it because I know you guys hated it so much. And to be honest, I tried my patience multiple times. A lot of the party stuff, I was like, just get back to the movie within the movie. That's far more interesting to dissect than watching everybody talk about him And mm-hmm.
So yeah. My issue with the Clouds of Sils Maria is the fact that mm-hmm. Armand mm-hmm. wrote it.
Yeah, but it was her right. idea. She came to him with the idea.
But then why didn't she write it?
He liked it, and I was like, I don't know. She didn't want to, I'm assuming. Went to writer, director, Oliver Assayas, and pitched the idea of the film to him. He liked it and wrote the script. I don't know. Mm. That's what it is.
Oh, then that makes a lot of sense. It does feel very personal to, what, Juliet. Well, the main character is kind of a mirror, a parallel to Juliet Binoche herself, right? Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that's intentional.
It also
Chloe
says...
Grace's Yeah?
She took the role in Godzilla so she can deliver a line in this movie.
That's why she showed up. Yeah.
Wow. So she could, like, deliver a line about acting in blockbusters.
Oh, my God.
Really? I don't
Well,
I think
she showed up for, like, 2 minutes in Godzilla. For one, she's in it for 2 minutes. She's in the very, very beginning. She's in the first scene. She's Bryan Cranston's wife, who dies in like the first minute of the film. Yeah. You don't need to watch it now. That's her contribution. She also showed up... No, fucking hell. She showed up in the Ghost in the Shell live-action remake. Crazy. Mm-hmm. I was like, how do they get her?
I'm pretty sure she was, like, out for a paycheck, and then was like, you know what? I did this so I could do the method.
I could do this. I'm okay with doing this now. Doing this film is her, like, therapy of coming to terms with taking shitty Hollywood roles. I love how Chloe Grace Moretz's character is so obviously Kirsten Stewart right after Twilight. Mm. Like, the way they styled her hair and the I love that. It's a wonderful parallel. And Kirsten Stewart herself is kind of just... this caught in between, right? She's neither young enough to take on like Chloe Grace Moretz, like to be as she's not as young as she was when, you know, of course Twilight came out and she was like still a hot sensation, but now she also kind of is taking at that point of her career, I believe she's done like the On the Road adaptation already. She's been doing some like progressively critical work, and it's cool to see everybody play like a parallel of themselves. And
well, I think she's just doing Twilight. I don't see any different. What, thinking she's really, see, like,
maybe
interesting?
Maybe it's because we haven't
know?
Seen Twilight.
That's a good thing, to be honest.
So we don't know.
I think it's charming.
Yeah, it worked. I don't know. I thought it worked. But I haven't seen Twilight, so I don't know.
Because she's been doing... Well, she started out in indie. I remember her seeing her in Into the Wild.
She was in Zathura.
Yes, she was the sister in Zathura. She was great in that,
too. Off of Jumanji.
Yeah, I remember that movie. I had a huge crush on her.
She was amazing in Panic Room when I first... Yeah. Yes. You're like the ideal woman. I always thought she was a boy in Panic Room when I first watched it as a kid. I was like, that's a boy. She was very funny at Adventureland. I thought that was pretty good, too. So, yeah. Any more thoughts on both of these films?
Mm-mm. No.
What do you think about the significance of the snake, like in Clouds of Sils Maria? Because they were talking. So the film constantly is about the balance between text and reality, right? The play within the film is obviously another parallel between Julia Binoche and Kirsten Stewart's relationship, right? That of the superior and the assistant. And when they're talking about, like, oh, let's go see the snake, which is just, I guess, clouds, like the Clouds of Sils Maria.
Is it like...
Like
grasping fame, and then you miss it anyway.
Ooh, that's pretty good.
I don't know.
Yeah, because when you see the clouds at the end, you know, after Kirsten Stewart's character disappears, Julia Binoche has her own, like, well, it's a snake, but... It may not be a snake, but it's still very beautiful. It's worth a rewatch. I'm actually actually quite interested in rewatching the film and trying to piece together, like, because you know there's multiple scenes when they're doing rehearsals with each other, and it's starting to blur the line between are they acting, are these characters trying to actually have like an honest dialogue with each other, or are they just doing a play, or is it both? And it doesn't really matter if they are doing a play or not. I thought that was interesting. All right, shall we? To take a break?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. And we're back. Now, step right up, ladies and gentlemen, my favorite moment of the week. Let's rate these films. 7 reels, everybody. 7 reels. Who wants to go first?
I can do this.
Ooh, we have our first contender. Let's step up.
Can I give 7 to one movie and 0 to another?
These are your reels. You can do with them as you wish.
Okay, then 7 to The Clouds of Sils Maria. 0 to The Other Side of the Wind.
You hate it so much that the other film becomes perfect, like in comparison.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, Michelle, what are your opinions?
Probably 6 clouds, and then 1, the other one.
That's pretty generous. Based on how
I guess the clouds one didn't sit with me right. I don't know.
For me, I would say 2 for Other Side of the Wind. It's still a mess. I'm not disagreeing with it. Like, it's a mess of a movie. But I thought I got something from it. At least I thought I did. Maybe I just, like, Stockholm-centered myself into liking it. So, and yeah, I really enjoy Clouds of Sils Maria. I'm actually very much looking forward to rewatching it again, just to go over, like, some of the scenes. All right. This brings us to, what have we watched this week?
So, I watched the second episode of the Beatles documentary, Get Back. It's been, I think, 3 months or something that I watched the first one. Yeah, they just play a bunch of music, and then they decide to do the thing that they were going to do, which is... play a bunch of songs on a roof. So that's something, I guess.
It's hard to have real narrative stakes in reality.
Yeah, that's true. There was a cute scene where Linda McCartney's daughter was... Linda Eastman was that. She was there, and she was talking about her cats giving birth and the new little kittens in the house. And John Lennon talking to her about the cats. So that was cute.
That's very sweet.
Yeah.
I literally read something earlier about this conspiracy theory that Paul McCartney, like, died in the 60s. And people think there's, like, an actor who just looks like him.
They replaced all the photos now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And all those Wired videos of him going over his career. That's an actor.
Yep.
Yeah, they replaced him. They think he was replaced. But what?
There's a similar theory of Avril Lavigne. She died in like 2005.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She changed so much.
Yeah, she changed so much. It was big on Tumblr. Cool. And would you still recommend it?
The documentary?
Yes.
I mean, if you're like, I get the appeal if you're like really, really into the Beatles. Like, I get it. I would watch like a Stones documentary like this of them just messing around the studio and seeing like these songs that I know so well be like kind of go in different directions and then see like what they do. But I like the Beatles. I think they're great, and I'm never gonna be like, oh, they're okay or anything, but I do have my preferences, and they're not like they're not my favorite, like, 60s British Invasion rock band, so I'm kind of like over it. I'm gonna finish it though.
Peter Jackson did something special here, like in terms of like just compiling this and making this?
Well, I mean, I haven't seen the original footage, so I don't know what the choices he made are, but from what we've seen, I think he's just doing the best he can to kind of give it some structure, which is admirable, but I don't think it'll ever work. It's like,
it's too loose.
Yeah, you can't, like, you're just watching like paint dry. It's that they're working. They're not, being entertaining.
They're trying to make an album.
Yeah, and they do work hard.
I genuinely would want to give it a go. I like seeing like the creative process. I like seeing that.
So. Yeah. Okay. Well, if that's your thing, you'll like it, because they do work hard, and that's something I took away from it. Where I was like, wow, even the Beatles were working hard.
Oh yeah, sex don't come from nothing. Speaking of working hard for success, Michelle and I finished watching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel season 4. after a very meandering season, and I do mean meandering, like nothing happens, literally nothing happens. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of at the end. But by the end of the season, you can I can kind of see how that is by design. This is a season about like our main character being like what she is, what stands in her own path, her ego and her vanity, and then. So the rest of the season is just like she's not being able to move forward with her career or even with the narrative of the show because she's too caught up in trying to do her own thing and too caught up in trying to change, too stubborn to change. And then at the end of the season, she receives a wake-up call. And it's great. It's performed beautifully, I think. Very, very... the show is always very fun to watch because the direction they employ throughout the episodes that there's always these very fun, elaborate long takes that they feel quite seamless, and they're able to do both the long take and the comedy at the same time. But until they leverage that for drama at the very end, and I thought that was brilliant. So yeah, it's worth watching the kind of not great fourth season just to get to the end and kind of get the point.
But they could have really done it in about comedy. Two episodes.
They could have done it. Yes, they could have done it 2 episodes ago. Instead of this 8-episode season, it really should have just been 5. I think, and Yusuf, I'm really curious of what you would think about it, because it's so ingrained. It's about making it in comedy.
I honestly I've heard nothing but good things, even from like comedians who watch the show. So
I really do think you'll like it.
Yeah,
especially at the end, like when the guy like gives like a speech to her, he's like, "What do you like? What even constitutes a success with it?"
Because you know Lenny Bruce is. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who Lenny Bruce was until I watched the show.
Yeah,
And he's the guy who plays him. Amazing, amazing in this. Really, really good. Very charming.
Okay, I gotta watch it then. Keep saying and, that.
Lois from Family Guy is very good at this as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she's the manager, right?
She's the manager. She's really good. At one point, she does the Lois voice for like a brief second.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just for a little bit.
But not as like a nod to that. Okay.
No. She does never descends into flanderization. She's very much her own character. All right. Which brings us to our recommendations. What would you recommend our audience watch instead of Other Side of the Wind? I'm giving you guys, come on,
but why just that one? Why not the other one?
Yeah.
I was just going to ignore the other side of the park of
a good joke, with a good joke, just throwing it to you, okay? Literally anything else, ladies and gentlemen, literally anything else. F for Fake, literally watch his previous film. F for Fake is a better examination on like the artistic process, I suppose. Yeah. And also, if you like the girl, she's in this one as well. And yeah, he uses her in the exact same way.
That's a good one, F for Fake.
Did you think like the compositions were very Dali inspired in terms of like the film within the film? Michelle, does that echo any of that to you?
As in Salvador Dali?
The way they juxtapose her body against the architecture, I thought I got a little bit of that vibe.
On the other side of the wind.
Especially the last...
There has to be a story.
Yeah, and the last set that they were in, like kind of like the more deserty like vibe. Oh. Like I thought that kind of... A lot of the shots and compositions kind of evoked that to me. But
Yeah, but there still has to be a narrative for me at least.
It has to be it has to be a movie.
Okay, well, I want to recommend 8.5.
That's a good one.
That's also about a director trying to make a... His magnum
opus. It would be Fellini.
Yeah.
My recommendation My Car.
Oh.
I haven't said mine yet.
I thought you were saying
everything.
I just thought about that.
That could be a good recommendation.
That could be a good recommendation. Just watch that. My original recommendation is... Yusuke Hamaguchi's Drive My Car, which came out last
3
year.
Hours.
It's
very similar to both of these films. Mm-hmm. And arguably, you would probably like it a lot better than Orson Welles.
Oh, you can like anything better than that. Well. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Okay, mine is Woody Allen's Rifkin's Festival, which...
Mm. His latest one.
Yes, and I think his last film... Even though I think he's written some short, but still, because it's not about Maggie. It's more like he's going back through the films that he made and the films that influenced the films that he made, but disguised as a guy who, he's just a writer who is like failed his whole life. He can't write anything. And he's just like going through everything. I did not sell that well at all, but it's similar. Way better. Heard of it.
I'll watch it.
So.
Well, yeah, no one's heard of it because it's post-cancellation Woody Allen.
Mm.
Cool. Well, that brings us to our films for next week. It's my turn to pick. So I want to go over grungy, shortish films that are set in New York. And the first one, it'll be really embarrassing and none of them are actually set in New York, is After Hours, which I believe is set in New York. Please, like, I hope I'm right. I'm not going to look it up.
There's a huge chance it is. Don't worry.
it's Martin Scorsese's After Hours. And, okay, good.
There's one film in Italy. That's New York.
Well, technically, Gangs in New York was technically Italy because they shot in Italy.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, what's the other one?
The other one... Okay.
Sorry. It's Madonna's...
Yes, it's... We're watching A League of Their Own. Wait, sorry, not A League of Their Own. Sorry, not A League of Their Own. No, sorry. I completely cut that out. I completely forgot the name. Of Desperately Seeking Susie.
They're not even similar.
We're watching Desperately Seeking Susie starring Madonna because I saw on Twitter that this was set in New York, so we're watching that. I don't know why I came up with League of Their Own. I can't remember these titles. All right, that's what we're watching.
That's great.
Now we're going to call it a day.
Bye.
Have a great, stay safe. I didn't say have a great time. I don't know why I even said that. I will keep it real, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye. The 7th Reel is hosted by Arvin Huang, Michelle Hassel, and Yusuf Al-Bashir. Logo by Joe Conti. Our ad break music is composed by Yusuf Sui Lim, and our outro music is composed by Yahya Al-Bashir. Thanks for listening.